It's a pleasure to be here. Can you hear me back, Bob? Mm-hmm. It's a pleasure to see so many friends, colleagues, and former students. And of course, it's an honor to share the podium with David. I always learn things when I listen to David. I hope the converse is true. Moshe didn't say that I almost didn't get here because there was a snowstorm in Baltimore, and I was snowbound for 3 days. My son was getting married, and I figured he'd want me to be there. But afterwards, turned out there was a Star Trek convention, so I really feel very happy. That's actually more fun than anything I've ever been to at the fields, even the fields. Anyway, this is a talk. It's more like a case study. It's an interesting contract that I came across when we were in sabbatical in the United Kingdom in London. And if it's only a case study, we don't really have a solution to this problem. But it's interesting. It's an interesting problem in risk management, and it has to do with the problem that arose in insurance. And I think the area of insurance, I commend Moshe, is a really an area that could benefit from some areas of modern finance. And I think the converse is true. Some of those actuarial techniques are actually quite useful in finance. So I give a little bit of background about the United Kingdom insurance products. I'll describe the embedded option that is going to be the thing I'm talking about. It's called a guaranteed annuity option. I'll explain this term in a second. We'll use the initials GAO, even though I haven't described it yet. We look at a time series analysis of the factors. There's going to be three things that affect the value of this option, and we'll see how they moved over time. And we'll look at the maturity value of this option over time. We look at some methods of managing the risk, and we look at the pricing issue. But in this case, the pricing, this thing had a price of zero at inception. The real problem here, as often in banks, is not pricing, it's hedging, and some lessons to be learned. You can interrupt me as I go through, or you can wait to the end. There's a worldwide trend towards more sophisticated features in retail products, and there's actually a worldwide trend towards people making their own investment decisions. We see that defined contribution pension plans. Banks, financial institutions, and insurance companies are offering increasingly sophisticated products to their consumers. A range of benefits and options, and there's a lot of built-in options on associated now with insurance contracts. You can have a call option to participate in the growth of the equity market, or in Canada we have so-called segregated fund contracts where they provide a long-term embedded put option. In the United States, you have so-called equity indexed annuities, which aren't really annuities. They have a rich variety of options. They have Asian options, look-back features, etc. And just three recent examples of the financial consequences of writing these options and always not, sometimes not hedging them or hedging them. September the 4th last, the Wall Street Journal reported that the large insurance company Cigna had lost 700 and change U.S. dollars, and it had to make that charge to cover the liabilities under its death benefit insurance, sort of a look, roughly speaking, a look-back policy, and the market is high. It was quite high during the reign of President Clinton. It seems to have gone down with his successor. And so the market was quite high, and as it fell, this was a very huge liability which wasn't hedged. There was quite a fuss a couple of years ago in Canada under the so-called segregated fund contracts, where very complicated put options were embedded in insurance contracts. And the one that we will speak about are the guaranteed annuity options, which were written in the United Kingdom and also in other countries. And these almost wiped out several large UK insurance companies, including the oldest insurance company in the world, Equitable Life, a very important insurance company. I need to give you just a little bit of background here. Some of you know this, but some of you may not. In the United Kingdom, for our purposes, there's two types of policies. The so-called with-profits policies, where a consumer pays premiums each year to the insurance company, and then at maturity they get a final amount. There's bonuses. The insurance companies learned early on to charge a little more than they needed to, and so they give some of it back by way of bonuses. And these bonuses are declared each year, they're added to the sum assured, they're payable on death or maturity. And then, if the market does really well, there's a settling up bonus, which, if under good equity performance, you give in addition to the sum assured, which may be of the order of the sum assured. In the United Kingdom, insurance companies have been big investors in the stock market, and the returns to these with-profit policies are, of course, pretty well correlated with stock market performance. The other product I want to talk about are the so-called unit-linked contracts, and in this case, the investment risk is passed directly to the policyholder. A notional sort of account is set up, and the investment gains and losses passed right through to the consumer after a certain administrative charge. It's like mutual fund plus insurance, and often these things have a particular tax advantage. And these contracts in Canada are called the segregated fund contracts because they're supposed to be kept segregated from the rest of the assets and liabilities of the insurance company. And certainly under a unit-linked contract, the maturity amount is directly linked to the performance of the reference portfolio. And once again, you have good returns when the stock market does well. And in the last 20 years, of the previous century, the stock market did really well. In the United Kingdom, these policies were used to fund retirement income, and 65 was the retirement age for males, and the policy proceeds were converted into a life annuity payable as long as the retiree lives. Now, the amount of the annuity available would depend on the amount of money that the retiree had, either from the with-profits policy or the unit-linked policy. The more money you have, other things being equal, the more pension you have. It will also depend on the rolling interest rates available at retirement, and it will depend on the expense assumption and the prevailing mortality at retirement, because if people are living a long time, it takes more funds to fund a particular pension. So just for, this is a nice contract with David's tough, but arithmetic, really. Assume the retiree lives 13 years after retirement, then the annual payment A, produced by a lump sum of 1,000, at an interest rate of I, is by solving this very, very simple problem. So as interest rates rise, A rises. As interest rates fall, A falls. So this is, here's the interest rate. This is the amount of annuity purchased by £1,000 in this case. It would be £1,000 at retirement. And if they're using an interest rate of 5.7%, they would get £111 per annum. If interest rates are zero, they'll only get this amount, which is 1,000 divided by 13. And if interest rates are 15%, then you get £180 per annum. So these insurance companies, what they did was they guaranteed a fixed monetary amount at retirement. So they embedded a guarantee whereby the retiring individual would always get at least 111. And so if interest rates are very low, the insurance company said it would pay at least this amount, but if interest rates are very high, of course, the guarantee didn't work. So that just shows the amount of annuity as a function of the interest rate. And many pension policies issued in the 70s and 80s contained this guarantee. The common guaranteed rate was 9 for males aged 65, and that meant each $1,000 of proceeds was guaranteed to, if you divide 9 into 1,000, you get approximately 111. So they provided 111 pounds per annum, and this was payable during retirement. This guarantee was issued when long rates were very high, I mean really high. Some people in the audience may remember this far back, some may not. I remember very well because I was living in Vancouver and my mortgage was up for renewal, and interest rates in Canada were like 18%. So this option becomes more valuable if interest rates fall. Initially, the option was well out of the money. It was so far out of the money that the price was essentially zero on any model. Essentially zero. And the liability was totally neglected by the insurance companies until the mid-1990s. It turned out that it was just thrown in as a marketing device. The same company would sell two policies, one with the guarantee, one without the guarantee, and charge the same amount. And it's a connection with David's talk that I hadn't seen before. At least one of those is wrong, right? The liability threatened the solvency of UK insurers, and it brought down the venerable Equitable Life. I work with accountants, and one of my great joys is to criticize accountants, and it's been so easy these last few years that I just have had to stop. But in this case, I'm afraid it's the actuaries who bear the responsibility, and since I'm Irish, I can tell Irish jokes, and since I'm an actuary, I can criticize actuaries, and I think they really dropped the ball on this one. It's their job. If an insurance company goes solvent, it's the actuary's responsibility, or it goes insolvent. So long-term interest rates did fall in the United Kingdom. In 75, you can see, this is the long-term rate, and the short-term rate was actually higher. And they were in the United States as well, in Canada. And this is a worldwide trend. If you look at interest, this is why modeling interest rates is kind of a tricky sort of job. So the model you had in 75, this is the long-term mean. And your model should sort of say, well, if that's what everybody thinks the long rate is going to be, then it's like 18%, and it pretty well came down, and has come down through the last two decades. So if you're sitting here, interest rates are 14%, the probability of interest rates getting as low as 4 or 5% was considered zero, and very, very, very low. Well, if people live longer, which is generally viewed as a good thing, life annuities become more expensive. Just suppose that the person aged 65 now would live 16 years instead of the 13 years as previously discussed. The annuity now is found by solving this very simple equation. 1,000 is A times j equals 1 to 16, 1 over 1 plus I raised to the power of j. So this annuity is going to be last for 3 years more. This is not actually how people calculate annuities for life insurance, but it gives you the idea. In this case, the interest rate that corresponds to 111 is 7.7%, and the guarantee becomes effective if interest rates fall below 7.7%. The option becomes in the money if I gets underneath 7.7%. So this lower curve is the curve when the person is living 16 years from retirement, and the top curve is when they're only living 13 years. And you can see for this curve, the option now is in the money for a longer span of interest rate, 7.7% relative to 5.7%. So if people were to live longer, the guarantee would become more expensive. And we just now let's look at the maturity value of the guaranteed annuity option. Hopefully it's clear what this option is. It's an option at maturity whereby the life insured gets a fixed, I was going to say dollar amount, a fixed monetary amount if interest rates happen to be low. If ST is the amount of the proceeds at time T, and T is the when the policyholder retires, and A65T is the market annuity rate at time T for a life who will be age 65 at retirement, the maturity value of the guarantee is this simple option type formula. It's directly proportional to FT. The more money you have, the bigger the value of the more important the guarantee. And then it's the maximum of AT over 9 minus 1 and 0. It'll probably be simpler if we do a little conversion and just assume that we've 1,000 units at retirement, so FT is equal to 1,000. So it's 1,000 times the maximum of AT over 9 minus 1 and 0. So if you multiply inside by 1,000, it's a maximum of 111 A65. So that is the market value of paying 111, and that's the amount you have, it's 1,000. So if interest rates are very low, this number becomes high and it may exceed 1,000. So that you could think of this as like a bond. If interest rates are high, this becomes low and the guarantee doesn't operate. So the guarantee operates when interest rates become low. We look at three mortality tables. I apologize for bringing in these. These names are totally non-mnemonic. They make no sense whatever. And they keep changing the notation. So let's just think of a mortality table that would have been appropriate in the 70s. The other, that's called A55. This mortality table is appropriate through the middle of the period, and this final mortality table is an up-to-date, real, you know, very modern mortality table that would be appropriate in the UK today for writing life annuities. If we look at the expectation of life to a male age 65 under these three tables, when these policies were written, the expectation of life was 14.3. About three quarters way through the period in the 85, it had shot up to 16.9. And currently, for this class of business in the United Kingdom, a male age 65 can expect to live 20 years. So this is a pretty dramatic improvement in life expectancy over a 30-year period. It's essentially almost 6 years. It's huge. Obviously, that can't keep going on, or we're in big trouble. But it's a huge improvement in mortality. Well, what did it do to this benchmark critical interest rate? Well, the interest rate was 5.6 when the policies were written. And the people, you're writing this business with, it's very long-term business, so they didn't build in a mortality improvement, and the mortality did improve, and they didn't foresee it, they didn't anticipate it, and there were actuaries, and perhaps they should have, but they didn't, at least not to the extent it did. And so the current mortality, an 8% interest rate, would trigger the guarantee. There's actually, you can think of this as an option on interest rates and mortality, and Moshe has a nice paper, and Moshe on this as well. So this is putting these two pictures together. I think we can tell a lot. These are years. This jiggedy curve is the UK interest rate, the long-term interest rate, and these three horizontal lines are the interest rates that bring these contracts into the money, make them expensive. Well, the original mortality, they didn't come into the money until a couple of years ago. But as interest rates fell and people began to live longer, the critical interest rate moved up and up. So you can see that this option is becoming more valuable for two reasons. First, because interest rates fell, and secondly, because people lived longer. And there's actually four reasons why these things became valuable. Recall that the maturity value of the guarantee at maturity was proportional to maturity proceeds. And the maturity proceeds were essentially either invested directly in equities or indirectly through the way that insurance companies distribute their bonuses. Over this 20-year period, the return on the benchmark UK index, which is called the FTSE, was 18% per annum. I thought I'd made an error when I did the calculation. So that's 18% per annum compound. That's a kind of a nice rate of return. So the returns on the with-profit business, even if they mess it up a little bit and don't get it right, usually not everyone, as you look at mutual funds, they don't all get the market return, but, you know, should the returns, insurance company returns were pretty high over this. The returns in unit-linked business were high, but also more volatile. Well, these good returns precisely make the problem for the insurance company worse, because the class of business, the amount of money to which the guarantee applies, becomes more and more. So this is the value of the maturing guarantee, and that's just looking at maturity. I'm not doing any fancy stuff, I'm not doing any option pricing or anything. Just starting at 1990, the value of the maturing guarantee was zero. It's zero unless the interest rate is, you know, unless the current annuity rate based on the prevailing interest rate for £111 per annum exceeds 1,000. And it doesn't come in the money until this year. But that's based on the very old mortality, but people, you know, if mortality improves, it doesn't improve on one day. It improves in a secular fashion. So over this time period, mortality was improving. So we're just standing in 1980, looking forward and assuming that mortality didn't change, but looking at the interest rates that did occur, that's the way it would have happened. So this is 9 per 100 at maturity. So for each 100 units at maturity, the value of the guarantee would have been an additional 9 at maturity. Well, this is why mortality is important. The mortality, the fact that people lived longer and the option was computed on the more up-to-date mortality, increased it from, this is the 9 from the previous graph, up to almost 40, increased it by a factor of 4, and it began to appear earlier. So the improving mortality also served to make a big impact in the value of the guarantee. So the story so far. When they were written, they were so far out of the money that the value was zero. The value of the option would increase with the fall in interest rate, people living longer, good equity returns, and then there was a fourth factor. Because the journalists in The Guardian and The Financial Times said that these policies written by Equitable Life and Scottish Widows, they may have a guarantee. And people said, Uncle Joe, you know that old policy you have? They dragged it out and they read it and they found, oh yeah, we have the guarantee. So this public awareness actually also served to increase the value of the option's existence. So often in insurance, you're not getting people exercising things exactly rationally. There's a kind of an inertia. But this, the fact that there was a problem made the problem worse. All four of these happened. So how was the risk managed? Well, the risk was not managed very well. The liability was ignored when the contracts were written. And neglected. People forgot about it. They didn't value the contracts. The policy was lying in a drawer. They didn't realize it. So it wasn't recognized. It wasn't disclosed. And these are complex long-term options that are incredibly difficult to hedge. At least we thought so. It should have been possible to price them from the 1980s onwards, because the where option pricing formula in the interest rate options, I've had this discussion with David. Interest rate options, 1980s, early 80s, there actually weren't any traded or many traded interest rate options. But interest rate options were embedded in other contracts, and academics began writing papers about interest rate options in the early 80s, and they were published. Jamshidian had a paper in 79. So the technology was available in the public domain, at least for pricing them, and of course actuaries didn't sort of subscribe to these newfangled ideas. There's three ways at least to manage the risk, probably four. This is the old simple actuarial way. It's costly, but it works. The Warren Buffett approach. Just keep a pool of capital around, and that often can be very helpful. The insurer sets aside additional capital, and then with a high probability, this capital will be sufficient to pay the liabilities. It's a bit like a value at risk or quantile approach. They're estimated using stochastic simulation and the use of stochastic model. It's a VAR idea. David's co-author, Philippe, wouldn't like me using the word VAR. Tail VAR would be better. So these simulations are used to estimate the distribution of the cost, and then you can find the amount of capital you would need so the provision would be adequate 99% of the time. My friend David Wilkie has done this calculation and found that that wouldn't have been enough. I mean, if you're writing really long-term business, amazing things can happen. So giving long-term guarantees isn't really a very smart idea. This is even if contingency reserves at 1 in 1,000 had been set at the end of 84, there would not have been enough. But their insufficiency would have alerted people to what's going on. Okay. Second approach is to reinsure the liabilities with a reinsurance company or investment bank. The insurer buys the corresponding option from an investment bank. Scottish Widows brought sort of a receiver swaptions, essentially, from Morgan Stanley. Cost £1.5 billion sterling, and that was a requisite for them to be taken over. When this method is used, I'm not applying anything about Morgan Stanley, but the people in the UK are worried about, you know, if you reinsure, then the credit worthiness of the counterparty becomes important if it's a 30-year contract. Dynamic hedging, this is where we thought we could make some progress, but our progress has been very limited so far because there's a lot of things that make it a problem. We know the theory. We set up in a complete market, an initial portfolio of traded securities. We have some formula for the derivative, and it magically gives us the weights, and we adjust this thing dynamically over time, and at the end of the day, this precisely replicates the payoff. This is what we teach our students, at least in the beginning. And in the guaranteed annuity situation, there are many challenges to you, and I welcome any suggestions or questions on this that we found using this. Yes, I know. Yeah, but why it doesn't work? Yeah. Oh, well, we'll sort of keep going. Yeah, there's a lot of reasons why it doesn't work. One of the first reasons is, let me just go back here. No, that's good. I'm really glad. Okay, because it's dark in here, and I'm really glad that at least you're. The liability is proportional to ST. This is another method. This is kind of the unusual method. One way to reduce the liability for the with profits policies was to control the size of ST. This is like a reverse moral hazard. The insurance company, when it gives you the bonuses, is contributing to the size of ST. And the Equitable Life in 1993 said, okay, we're giving people terminal bonuses, but you guys, you've got this guarantee. We're not going to give you big bonuses because you're already getting a lot of money from us or a lot of benefit. This went through every court in the UK, and it ended up at the final court, which is the House of Lords. And the House of Lords, in my opinion, got it absolutely right. It said if you give a guarantee, it is a guarantee. And if you're paying for it yourself, then they kind of messed it up. And the sad thing about the Equitable Life was these were the good guys. This was a really good insurance company. Low commissions. They didn't put a lot of money under the table. They paid it all out to their policyholders. And in fact, it turned out that when it was being went to the various courts, they had trouble getting judges because all the judges, professional people, they were all policyholders almost of Equitable Life. Stochastic interest rate models. Well, I mean, you could start with a one-factor interest rate model. If you can sort of, it's of course very easy to be armchair quarterback. But if you go back to 1980, there weren't many multi-factor interest rate models. And probably one of the earliest was the Vasicek model. So you could assume the short-term interest rate follows a diffusion process like this. It's just the standard Ornstein-Uhlenbeck. Well, if you have that, then what value do you use for theta in 1980? If you use a value of 12%, you're not going to get any value for this guarantee. And yet, if you have a value of 5%, you're going to look at the market and say, gee, long-term interest rates are uneven with the risk premium. So it's not immediately obvious how you would calibrate this model. Okay. Well, kappa and theta as well. So that was one. And that's, I don't need that for this audience. Valuation under stochastic interest rate models, people know how to do that. And that's just taking a numerator, taking the expected value. And in this case, you have a very nice, elegant solution for the zero coupon bond price. And not only a one factor, but several factor interest rate models. Options and bonds, Brennan Schwartz were working in this in the 1980s. Jamshidian had a model in 89. Actually, one of my own students had a generalization of this model in 87. And I'm sure lots of other people had models for options and bonds. And Jamshidian's model is a European call option on a pure discount bond. And it's very like a Black-Scholes type formula. And it turns out you can actually calibrate this model to the current term structure of interest rates, which was done by Hull and White and also by Phil Didvig and probably a few others. And this is kind of a Heath Jar Morton approach, essentially. This is once you start using the forward rate, which I think was the genius of the Heath Jar Morton approach, you input the forward rate, then you start from what you know. So that would have if you use a one-factor interest rate model or a multi-factor interest rate model, you could calibrate it to the existing term structure. There weren't many derivatives around, so getting the volatilities would have been a problem. But you can set this thing up, at least initially, as an option on a coupon bond, and ignoring the equity risk, which is an important thing, and ignoring the mortality risk, you could get a pretty simple formula that would be a derivation of the Jamshidian and Digvig formula in a one-factor context. It would give you a model that would price correctly all the zero-coupon bonds. Now, of course, you haven't got the volatility or the kappa, but at least you can get a method for pricing these things. And the formula is like what you would expect. This is a little bit of survival. This is ST, and I'm assuming here that the stock and the bond are independent, which of course is a pretty strong assumption, but over 30 years, what is the right assumption? And then this becomes a Jamshidian type thing. So what you can do is you can get a formula for the guaranteed annuity option. If you make really strong assumptions, you assume that the equity returns are independent of the interest rates. You can actually modify that. You can have them correlated. And this particular formula is such that the zero coupon bonds are properly priced. So it's like you could think of this as an option on a coupon bond with a little bit of mortality strewn in there. So GT is the price of the guaranteed annuity option at current time. The policy matures at time capital T when the life is aged R, X plus T minus T. This symbol T minus T PX is the probability of survival to retirement, and these AJs are the little fixes that the Jamshidian used to get a single. This will work for a one-factor model. You can get you can price a coupon bond in a one-factor model in a very simple sort of way. And DTT is a zero coupon bond price. We're assuming here that stocks and interest rates are independent, and ST is the current portfolio value. This is a very, very simple formula. So we need to make another adjustment. The Vasicek model will not fit the input term structures, so you have to calibrate it using the Didvig Hull-White approach. Or there's a couple of papers out that just go directly to the Heath-Jarr-Martin approach. But back in the mid-80s, that was not available. And these are some values that we used. It turns out if you calibrate the model, it doesn't matter what your long-term theta is because it's picked up from the calibration. We used this value of sigma, and you can vary the values of kappa. The most volatility is the most critical value for the value of an option. And these parameters were based on those in the literature and UK data for this time period. There's been a lot of work on estimating these. And this is sort of, these are the input parameters that we used. We looked at a contract with 10 years to go, and we assumed that the stock return was independent of interest rates. So this is just a very simple little formula. These are the time series of the market values of the guaranteed annuity option. This is a male who's This is a set of males who's aged 55 in 1980, 10 years to go. And then in 1985, another male aged 55 with 10 years to go. So it's running through time, looking at the value of an option, which is a constant 10 years to maturity. And we're using the old mortality. We're using these Vasicek-type parameters. But we're calibrating it to the current term structure, which is observable. And now we see it's very like the earlier graph, but we get this little blip in 1995. Now, if you use the up-to-date mortality, which is people in 1980 would not have been using this mortality, but this is the market value, more or less, of the option. Now, you may disagree with the assumptions I've made, but this is like one estimate of the market value. And now, if you look at the market value over time, using option pricing. If the actuaries had used option pricing, they could at least have seen this thing was beginning to show some small value in the 80s because interest rates were coming down, mortality was going up, you had two lines that were going to meet, right? And so this was the market value of the guaranteed annuity option with 10 years to option maturity. Okay. Now, what about some sensitivity analysis? Well, let's just The volatility is one of the more important parameters, and I picked quite a range of volatilities, Jamshidian Vasicek model, from 15% to 35%. And you'll find that for a lot of the observations, these curves coincide. And the reason is, it's very simple. Think of a call option. If it's a way out of the money, its value is zero. It doesn't depend on the volatility. If it's a way in the money, it doesn't depend very much on the volatility either. So this graph, I think, we could say gives a reasonable approximation. And one of my colleagues at Waterloo thinks I'm being too rash in saying this. But we would claim this gives a reasonable probability of the market value of the guaranteed annuity option. But then the question is, you can compute the market value. What on earth do you do with this price if you sold it? Where do you invest the funds? You need a model to hedge it. Right? Or that's one way. And so, in the ideal case, perfectly frictionless markets, no arbitrage, continuous trading, complete market, and enough of these traded securities then the current price of any option can be, as I said, expressed in a portfolio of traded securities. And the formula in the textbook case tells us how to replicate these things. You adjust the portfolio over time in the light of the asset price changes. Well, I think here you would need the so-called physical measure, because you can't hedge every day. And you would need, although you've some sort of market value, it's far from clear that you've got the right model that describes the physical evolution of these parameters over time. There's many market imperfections. It's not possible to rebalance the replicating portfolio on a continuous basis. It has to be rebalanced at intervals. The asset price dynamics may be, I think, will be incorrectly specified. It's certainly, when they issued the contract 30 years ago, the technology wasn't such that we had a nice integrated model of stock and bonds. I might claim that even today we don't have such a model, that we would be confident over a 40 or 50 year period that we could hedge against. In the case of interest rates, it seems that there's three factors. Over long periods, it looks like regime switching models might provide some of an answer. But the GEO involves very long-term option that involves interest rates, stock returns, and mortality. Each one of these is tricky in its own right. So, some conclusions. We haven't. The insurers give away for free a very complicated long-term option with an open-ended liability. I mean, this thing wasn't a huge open-ended liability. Our viewpoint is that it should never have been written in the first place, because we had an option that on a market value basis was like worth zero, but the potential liability was huge. Once the options were written, they should have been monitored and the liabilities disclosed. The liability could be partly hedged by an insurer taking a long position in very long dated receiver swaptions. That would cover the interest rate portion, but there's a quantum dimension to this option. It wouldn't capture the connection with the equity returns, and it wouldn't deal with the mortality improvement. One way they could have improved it, they could have said, we will give you an annuity based on this interest rate at the then ruling mortality rate. One way you can avoid risk is by thinking a little about the contract design before you write it. So writing it as a monetary amount was not, in retrospect, a good idea. They could have said, if interest rates are below this amount, then on current mortality, we'll use current mortality to calculate the guarantee. Because the way that the interest rate and the immortality were conjoined, as people lived longer, the strike price of the option increased. The responsibility for the disaster should lie mainly with the actuaries, and professions have a responsibility, I think, to learn about advances in the relevant disciplines. So like David, I finished under the slot time. So I'm very happy to take any questions.